At Ewald's direction, they turned and speedwalked in a straight line until they reached a wall. From the floor to a height of about 7 feet, it was lined with narrow sheet metal enclosures, control panel after control panel, with LCD readouts, gauges, warning lights, and thousands upon thousands of exposed switches and terminals. All dead. As they followed the wall, to their right, out on the floor, a low, hulking cylindrical shape came into view. The 20-foot-wide, machined steel housing sat in a matching circular depression in the concrete. Ahead, there were more of the dam's generator turbines. One after another, they squatted, stretching off into the darkness. Around the silent machines were scattered bodies. A litter of corpses in random piles and puddles in varying states of decomposition. The vast generator room was both slaughterhouse and dumping ground. A kill zone even less defensible than the stairwell and hallway. Ewell pushed the others to a trot.
Move it! Move it!
They didn't get far. The clicking seemed to come from everywhere at once, from the gridwork of I-beams above and the far corners of the immense room. The hall's infuriating echo made it impossible to tell how many there were, or which way to run.
Shoot him! Why don't you shoot him?
Something moved out of the shadows at the edge of the torchlight. It moved past Ewell at chest height, so quickly he couldn't raise the machine pistol, let alone track the target. He glimpsed a blur of brown and got the impression of a sleek, banded body. Many legs. Powerful, jointed legs. There was a scraping sound, but the bright flash of a sword he was anticipating never came. The blur bounded high in the air. He thought he saw a turned-up butt like a deer's an instant before it vanished into the blackness ahead. Then something warm and wet splashed his good arm. As Ewell turned, Tolliver's torch dropped to the floor. Sheets of blood poured out from under the man's beard. Tolliver staggered, slamming back against the control panels, and upon impact, his head fell off. It didn't roll away like the guttering torch. It flopped to one side, toppling from his cleanly sliced neck, and hung there upside down, connected to his body by a strip of skin. Tolliver's legs gave way, and a blood waterfall became a blood fountain. Even though he couldn't see anything to shoot at, Ewald cut loose with a burst of autofire.
Other way, Wilde!
Reversing course, they sprinted along the wall. Ewald didn't want to return to the hallway, but he had no choice. He'd given up trying to find a quick way out. All he wanted now was cover. Some kind of cover. They found another metal door 50 yards down the corridor. It was unlocked. Ewald and Wilje stepped into a narrow, low-ceilinged room crammed with tall metal storage cabinets and open frame shelves. It looked safe enough. The exposed walls were free of weeping holes.
What are we gonna do?
The teenager had pissed himself. The insides of both trouser legs were dark, from crotch to cuff.
Let me think! Just shut up and let me think!
Then Ewald made the mistake of looking down at his arm, and his brain vapor-locked. The heaviest muscles, deltoid, tricep, bicep, had begun to slough off the bones like overcooked meat. Where his fingertips had been, red bone peeked through.
Where's it coming from?
Walls, ceiling, floor. Ewald couldn't locate the source, but it was close. It was very close. One of the cabinets behind Wilje shuddered, tipping forward, then crashed to the floor. Ewald blinked, and the boy was gone. Gone. His torch lay on the floor. Above the toppled cabinet was a gash in the wall. Ewald lunged for the hole, the Uzi up and ready in his fist. He saw the boy's face a split second before he disappeared around a bend in the burrow. A face blanched white with fear. Elbows wedged against the slimy walls, fingers desperately, futilely clawing. Ewald thrust the muzzle forward and pinned the trigger.
I'm fucked.
Gun smoke filled the gash. His ears were ringing. He couldn't tell if he'd shot through Wilje and hit whatever had snatched him away. Tossing the Uzi aside, Ewell turned his full attention to the barricade. After he cleared the door and opened it, he bent to pick up the boy's torch. As he straightened, the thing climbed out of the hole, head first, uninjured, and in no apparent hurry. It wasn't like any mutie he had ever seen. It had a crop of thick, bristling hairs, like spikes on top of its broad, flat skull. Its widespread eyes were solid black and huge. When it rose from a crouch, he saw the banded segments of its abdomen. It had 6 legs. The top pair were short, with talons at the ends. The second pair was longer, and the last 2 the longest of all. Standing on its back legs, it was as tall as he was.
Motherfuck me!
The open doorway was a foot from Yuld's back. The creature stood 15 feet away. Before it could step closer, he made his move. A pivot started, but never completed. The thing was across the gap and in his face, just as his hips started to turn. The flesh above his right nipple dimpled around the shaft of a black thorn, a long stinger that protruded from the top of the creature's wrist. Its talons and arm flexed rhythmically, and he felt the pressure of a massive injection. At once, cold flooded his torso, numbing cold. The small arm jerked back, withdrawing the stinger. Ewald clutched at the wound in his chest, the numbness spreading to his legs. Before he could take a step, his knees gave way. He slumped to the floor on his back and lay there, paralyzed. As he struggled for breath, the creature leaned over him. The thing opened its jaws impossibly wide and, puffing its abdomen in and out, began to dry heave in Yule's face. While they waited for Jack to return from the canyon bottom, Ryan and the others took a rest break. With the sun almost directly overhead, there was no shade. Every surface reflected blinding light and withering heat. To keep their heads and shoulders out of the sun, they made canopies of their coats, stretching them between the tops of low rocks. As they sat on the hard ground, they tipped back their canteens and sipped at the Anasazi's sludge. The thick, gritty liquid rasped down their throats. Once swallowed, it lay in their bellies like bags of wet cement. But they'd all drunk worse. Ryan cleared the mud from the back of his tongue. Through a shimmering curtain of heat waves, he took in the canyon's far rim. The valley had widened to about a half a mile, and its depth was more than 400 feet. There was no sign of a reservoir, no sign of the river that had been plugged to create it. In the low spots, there were no standing pools, stagnant or otherwise. Nothing green. There was blue, though. A tiny clump of bright blue, visible to the naked eye in the distance below. The plastic antifreeze jug stood out against the unrelenting beige of the canyon floor, flagging the water thief's abandoned campsite. The bastard had lit himself a fire down there and tossed away his empty containers before moving on in the direction of the dam. Jack had scaled the canyon wall, and when he reappeared on the rim a few minutes later, his bloodless face was slick with sweat, his white hair plastered to his skull, and his breath came in ragged gasps. Even Deathland's wild child was starting to show the effects of their ordeal.
Fire pit cold. Nothing left in ashes.
If the chiller had food, he didn't need to cook it, Ryan thought. Maybe something dried or smoked. Something the dead travelers had brought with them. Berries and nuts pounded into a paste, then set out in the sun to harden. Or strands of jerky. One thing for sure, the bastard wasn't living off wild game. Aside from the buzzards, whose guts and body cavities were usually so packed with yard-long flatworms that even a starving man wouldn't touch their meat, the companions hadn't seen anything alive. Not so much as a fly. The landscape had been scoured clean.
Cold fire means he's still a couple days ahead of us. We may never catch him.
Could be he's running on jolt.
The potent combination of methamphetamine, narcotic, and hallucinogen was Deathland's recreational drug and painkiller of choice. If the thief was staying high on jolt, he could keep walking despite hunger. Keep walking until his feet fell off.
The dam isn't far now, another 5 or 6 miles at most. Good chance that's where our friend will have set up camp.
The dam was their only hope. The bastard had either stopped there with whatever water he had left, or there was water in the bottom of the reservoir. If neither was the case, they were all headed for the last train west. The companions gathered up their coats and packs and trudged on. Exhaustion, dehydration, and the flat monotony of the trek made it difficult for Ryan to maintain his mental focus. His thoughts kept wandering back to the carnage they'd seen up canyon. Dying of thirst was one of the worst ways to check out. There was terrible pain, delirium, and a slow, lingering slide into death. The guy who'd blown off his own head had witnessed his friend's suffering and taken a shortcut. Ryan imagined that with his last breath, as he'd pressed that shotgun muzzle hard to his chin, he had cursed the thief to hell. Betrayal wasn't unusual in the Deathlands. It wasn't a kinder, gentler, I feel your pain kind of place. Sympathy was in shorter supply than cased ammo. Individual survival was all that mattered in the hellscape. Survival at any cost. A brutal philosophy that Ryan Cotter had been steeped in since birth. Over time, his friendships, his battles, and his relationship with his son Dean had widened his horizons. Ryan no longer dismissed out of hand the idea of risking his own skin for the sake of strangers, or in fighting for a just cause, instead of a thick wad of jack from the highest bidder. And he still grieved the disappearance of his son. After another hour of walking, as they rounded a sharp bend in the rim, the valley broadened enormously before them. 8 miles ahead, the canyon necked down again, and the sun blazed off a barrier of white concrete nearly as high as the rim. At the base of the dam, there was water. Not a great pre-dark reservoir, but a modest lake, bounded on three sides by green furrowed fields and stands of low trees. As if that wasn't miracle enough, there was also the Ville.
Dark night!
From a distance, it was like sky dark had never happened. Like the flooding of the canyon had never happened either. A mile or two from the near shore of the lake, stone and brick buildings clustered around a central square with a little park in the middle. The largest building was 3 stories tall, with a clock tower. On the far side of the city center stood a row of grain silos. A black strip of 2-lane highway paralleled that end of town. The road petered out in the middle of the plain, either buried under shifting sand or ripped away by receding waters.
Little Pueblo, just the way I remembered it.
'Tis indeed a wonderment. Further evidence that the hand of the Creator works in mysterious ways.
I'd say it was more a case of the law of physics working predictably.
And whose hand lies behind the laws of physics?
Why does there have to be a hand?
Touché, dear Mildred. I am sure we would all like to hear your explanation.
On Nuke Day, as you call it, the water was 500 feet deep over the town. All that liquid acted like a giant cushion to protect the buildings from shock and blast effects of incoming airburst missile strikes. My guess is the dam didn't get off so easy, and that's why the reservoir disappeared.
Could have been a near miss with an Earthshaker warhead. Those babies had an effective blast diameter of 500 miles.
That would explain how the entrance to that redoubt got uncovered. The ground tremors brought the whole cliff down. Cracked the dam open, too.
I don't see any people moving anywhere, and there's got to be people. Not just our water thief. Somebody's been tending those fields.
With rifle scope and binocs, Ryan and JB surveyed the terrain downrange. There was something else wrong with the picture. Unlike most other inhabited outposts in Deathlands, Little Pueblo didn't have a defensive berm of piled dirt and debris. There were no perimeter gun posts, no fortified gates. JB lowered the field glasses.
I suppose there could be snipers and spotters up here on the rim, although they wouldn't be much use.
Sure, JB.
Ryan had to agree with that assessment. The canyon was so wide that much of it was beyond the range of even super high velocity, 50 caliber mil-spec rounds. Cap and ball weapons would be about as effective as chucking rocks. Snipers spaced out on the rim couldn't protect the Ville from a large invading force. They couldn't concentrate enough fire to turn back attackers. The best they could do was harass. And then, only during the day. That was the problem with rim-based spotter outposts, too. They'd be useless at night. Even if somehow they saw the invaders coming, they wouldn't be able to direct defensive ambushes in the valley.
It's like they don't give a damn if they're overrun.
Or they know it isn't going to happen.
What do you mean, they know?
They're sitting on an oasis in the middle of a rad-blasted desert. The nearest Ville of any size must be 150 miles away. A gang of blackhearts that set out for Little Pueblo isn't going to be in shape to rob it by the time they get here. If they get here.
How would robbers even know it existed? After the reservoir was built, the Ville's name was probably taken off all the maps. It sure wasn't on the one in the redoubt. The only way to find Little Pueblo would be to stumble onto it by accident. Then you'd have to walk out again to gather a chilling crew, and then walk in again to do the looting.
It's a safe bet that's never happened. If it had, folks down there would know the desert wasn't enough to keep trouble out, and there'd be perimeter defenses.
Bastard thief got in maybe 2 days ago.
He could be swinging from a tree right now, or else his head's on a stick in the middle of that square. No way of telling what kind of reception the folks down there give to strangers.
We still need water and food, folks.
Wait for Doc, then Steele.
Dear lad, from this vantage point, the valley looks bucolic and peaceable in the extreme, with ample sustenance for all. Perhaps the residents would happily share their bounty with us, if only to get news of the world beyond the hellish plain.
Or chill us for blasters and ammo.
We have a better chance of fighting our way out during daylight. At least we can see trouble coming.
There's another problem, whether we steal what we need or not. It's going to be a bastard long march out of this desert.